Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If it's not actually a legislative speed record, it's got to be pretty close, especially when you consider the sheer size of the thing. The Senate made a $790 billion deal on the stimulus plan today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's great to have you with us today. It's the 11th of February, and this might be too high to set the bar, but when the economy eventually does recover, the events of this Wednesday might well have been the turning point. The House passed its stimulus package 2 days ago. The Senate just yesterday. Less than 24 hours later, boom, there's a deal. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is on stimulus patrol today. Hiya, John.
Hello, Kai.
I almost didn't believe it when I saw the news break that this deal had been reached. Crazy fast.
Pretty fast. Well, it seemed like all sides just sort of locked themselves in a room late yesterday afternoon and started going through the proposals line by line. They resumed again this morning. But, you know, in the end, the two bills were close in size, and the bulk of the spending was the same. There really was only about a $40 billion difference there that had to be hashed through. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, referred to that when he announced this agreement.
The bills were really quite similar, and I'm pleased to announce that we've been able to bridge those differences. Like any negotiation, this involved give and take, and if you don't mind my saying so, that's an understatement.
So it looks like this bill is headed now for conference committee approval and then on to the House and Senate floors.
All right, down to brass tacks, though, John. What's in, what's out? Who wins, who loses?
Well, the agreement was that they would be below $800 billion, so they've settled on $790 billion, which is a cut of $30 or $40 billion. And they want to keep the support of at least three Republican senators. So despite some lobbying by governors, the final deal slashes $35 billion from aid to states. It eliminates $16 billion in aid for school construction. But the president will have his make work pay tax break for individuals, although it might not be quite as large as he first proposed at $500 an individual. The final bill will keep a tax credit for home buyers, although, again, maybe not the full $15,000 that the Senate approved. The House is apparently willing to accept the fix for the alternative minimum tax. That doesn't really stimulate the economy, but it does shield shield upper middle class workers from higher taxes.
Prognosticate for me here for a minute, John. The president got shut out in the House. 188 Republicans voted against this thing, all of them. Any chance he's going to pick up some votes this time around?
Probably not. There's not much here for the House Republicans to sign on to. He will keep the three Republican senators, Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins of Maine and Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter. All three of them were at the announcement of the deal this afternoon. Senator Snowe said the agreement satisfies her bottom line.
The key is making sure that we provide everything in this legislation that isn't just a matter of spending federal dollars, but that every dollar is spent efficiently and effectively and that it's geared for stimulus.
Last thing, John, before we let you go, now what happens? I mean, just because we're spending $790 billion doesn't mean the economy's fixed, right?
Well, the promise of this is that it will first give consumers some cash in their pockets to spend at the mall. It's supposedly going to create 3.5 million jobs, as well as build some necessary infrastructure in transportation and energy and education, which, in the president's vision, creates a more efficient and smoother running economy in the long run.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington talking about the stimulus bill. Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Kai.
Wall Street dilly-dallied today. Things didn't really get going until news of that stimulus deal broke. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It wasn't all stimulus all the time in Congress today. The House Financial Services Committee threw itself a nice little barbecue, grilling eight big bank CEOs over their roles in the financial crisis. The witnesses tried to be contrite. They acknowledged how angry people are over the state of affairs. But it is worth asking this question. The men who are at the witness table are the ones who still have their jobs, which at least implies that they're not the worst offenders. So where were the ones who got fired? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The bank CEOs squirmed as lawmakers demanded to know where government bailout money went or simply vented. Here's California Democrat Maxine Waters.
Let me just say to our captains of the universe who are sitting here before us that I have been in disagreement with the banking community.
But that community also includes former bank CEOs. You know, the guys who snapped up securities backed by wobbly subprime loans and bet that housing prices would never go down. John Steele Gordon is a financial historian.
These guys should certainly be called to testify as to what they did and why they did it.
They made a mess that the current CEOs inherited, says Peter Henning. He's a former Justice Department and SEC lawyer. And he says these current CEOs were sometimes forced into government solutions like the federal bailout or dubious deals with weaker rivals.
You have the government forcing banks to walk the plank. And you can question whether this is the right way for the government to have used its authority.
But former Fed Vice Chair Alice Rivlin says we shouldn't let the current CEOs entirely off the hook. She says if we want to fix the economy, we have to talk to them.
The big question now is not whose fault it was, although we can learn something from that. It's what do we do now?
And how do we keep the current CEOs from following in the footsteps of their predecessors? In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Even though Congress has reached a deal on the stimulus package, there is one big part of the economy that's still struggling. That'd be housing, of course. And for those who say, hey, why not throw a big chunk of stimulus that way? Marketplace's Dan Gretsch explains that's easier said than done.
The housing bubble came with its own lingo. There were terms for risky borrowers, like Alt-A and subprime. And then there were the risky loans, Neg-Am, interest-only, option arms. Mahmoud El-Gamal is economics chair at Rice University.
What the exotic mortgages did was to put a lot more risk on the banks' balance sheets without those banks recognizing how much risk they were taking.
Those exotic mortgages were then chopped up and sold to investors who, just like banks, had no clue about the risks. The mortgages mature at different rates or are pegged to different indices or are split between multiple lenders. No one knows what these mortgages with funny names are actually worth. Real estate expert Elise Glink.
There's no one central database where you can click on 10,000 loans at a time, modify all of the terms, click OK, and voila, it's all modified.
Glink says we now need to create jobs so people can pay their mortgage, loosen up credit so people can buy again, work through the millions of foreclosures, and set a price floor to restore confidence in a system that's clearly broken.
I think it's silly to talk about a single stimulus as solving everything because last year we had a whole bunch of different kinds of stimuli with trillions of dollars being spent, and all of that is just starting to work.
So what's the quick fix then? On this point, at least, experts agree. There isn't one. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
We've got a cliche wall going here in the office, listing all the no-nos we're tempted to use sometimes to describe the economic mess we're in. You know, things like tough economic times and feeling the pinch. Since the phrase silver lining isn't there yet, I'm going to go ahead and use it. For those who've been looking for a silver lining of good news amid all the bad, there was a small one today. The U.S. trade deficit fell in December to its lowest level in almost 6 years. Overall, in 2008, the trade imbalance narrowed for the second year in a row. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports from Washington, it's only good news if you don't look too closely.
So the trade deficit's falling, and that's good, right? Well, maybe not.
There's nothing like a good, strong recession to bring down the trade deficit.
Gary Huffbauer is an economist at the Peterson Institute. He says our trade deficit's declining because so many Americans feel broke.
I would say it's a very small silver lining given the pain we are all going through to get this number down.
Now, if the rest of the world were feeling flush and snapping up American exports, it would be good news. But
the bad news is that the rest of the world's also going through a recession, which means that our exports are finding a tough market overseas.
Greg Mestel is author of The Rise of the Chinese Economy. He says U.S. exports fell 6% in December, and that hurts American manufacturers. But if you think that's bad, consider China. According to customs data released this week, Chinese exports fell more than 17% last month. And Huffbauer wonders if American consumers, who have fueled so much economic growth around the world, will ever recover.
This is such a shock that I believe American behavior will change.
Huffbauer thinks from now on, Americans will spend less and save more.
Absolutely, and that will structurally change the size of our deficit.
And the contours of the global economy. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, I'll tell you what, if silver lining wasn't on the cliche wall before, it's going to be real soon. Take you back to last Friday in the January unemployment report. It was dismal. Almost 600,000 jobs disappeared from the economy. Almost every industry lost ground, except three: healthcare, private education, and the federal government. That last one probably explains why 4,000 people showed up at a military job fair near Washington, D.C. last weekend. Tamara Keith was there too.
The 300 to 400 jobs on offer in this community college gymnasium are white-collar civilian jobs at the Army's Aberdeen Proving Ground. The installation is growing at a time when many bases and huge swaths of the private sector are shrinking. Here, the Army is looking for some strong accountants, IT professionals, engineers, and logistics specialists. Phil Green is near the end of a long line. A very long line, trying to submit his resume.
You probably got 100 people out here trying for one job opening, so, and the process is 3 to 6 months for this go around. Figure out the odds. It's like buying a lottery ticket.
Green is an Oracle database administrator. It's an IT thing. He worked for an energy company until December when the company had a big layoff.
Layoff indicates you'll possibly come back, but that's not an option.
So he's beating the street, searching for a job to equal his skills and something else: security.
Everybody wants to work for the government. They have secure jobs. Where are they going to go, you know?
The unemployed aren't the only ones seeking the shelter of a good government job. Most here are actually still employed in private industry, like Derek Harris.
Always looking for better opportunities.
Wearing a suit and a Bluetooth, he drove some 2 hours to attend the job fair.
I was on the phone today with one of my best friends, and he just was let go. You just can't tell where the economy is today, so a government job is a little more secure.
This doesn't surprise Stephen Fuller. He teaches public policy at George Mason University. He says most people haven't experienced a downturn this bad before, and that has everyone watching their backs and looking for a plan B.
Right now, when there are job openings in government agencies, they attract very qualified workers who are working in companies that are probably okay, but they worry.
And so they line up, hoping to make a good impression.
Hi, how are you? Mark Engelhaupt. How are you doing?
Mark?
I'm interested in information technology field. So.
Mark Engelhaupt has 9-year-old twin daughters and an IT job in the printing industry that he isn't sure will last until it's time for them to go to college.
I'm 53 years old, so I'm looking for something I can retire from, looking for something a little bit more stable. Yeah, and the Army looks like a good place to do that.
Maybe it's just a sign of the times that a man with 30 years of experience in his field is walking around with a folder full of resumes. In Bel Air, Maryland, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Coming up, can sustainability outlast a down economy?
In the past, whenever there's been a downturn, companies have sort of said, okay, let's take a step back, and oh, by the way, the economy's bad, let's get rid of that whole environmental department because, you know, no one's suing us today.
But first, Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.2% today, 50 points, closed at 7,939, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ nudged up 0.3%, 5 points, finished at 1530. The S&P 500 also gained about 0.75%, 6 points, ended the day at 833. Bank CEOs may have gotten a grilling on the Hill today, but their company shares blasted higher. Bank of America jumped 9%, Citigroup 10%, J.P. Morgan ended roughly 6% higher. Both Ford and General Motors pulled about 1.5% higher on the stimulus package news. Tech had kind of a mixed day. Microsoft and IBM up 2%. Google fell 0.1%. Apple tumbled 1%. ExxonMobil dribbled 2% lower. Valero lost 0.75%. Oil lost 4% to $36 a barrel today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.7%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing people-ready enterprise solutions, software based on how people really work. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for January. A House Subcommittee on National Security and Foreign Affairs discusses U.S. efforts to train and equip the Afghan Army and Police. And the Lincoln Memorial is the scene of much activity. Celebrations take place marking the 200th anniversary of the 16th President's birth. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. One of the big criticisms of the way the Bush administration handled the bank bailout was that the public didn't really know what was going on. We didn't know what the plan was, especially as it kept changing. And we didn't know how bad the bank's balance sheets really were. That same criticism is now being leveled at the Obama administration, even though, or maybe because, yesterday Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner announced his plan to get banks to be more open. But there is a certain sausage factory element here that shouldn't be discounted, that maybe we don't want to know what's inside those banks. Ashley Miltite explains.
Members of Congress questioning bank CEOs today may say they want complete transparency, but New York securities lawyer Bill Singer says if they get it, they may not like what they see.
Well, the ugly detail is most likely that for every dollar that the public thinks is on the books of the banks and the brokerage firms, it may be 10 cents, it may be 20 cents.
Singer says financial institutions and the Treasury are buying time by not revealing too much. But he says they may be underestimating the public's stomach for bad news.
Anybody that's ever been a patient wants their doctor to give it to them straight. Let me deal with the stress. Let me deal with the problem.
The problem could be so large that it causes markets to crash. But Matthew Slaughter of the Tuck School of Business says ripping off the bandage and revealing the full wound could be the best option.
There might be a healthy benefit of trying to reduce the degree of uncertainty among a lot of investors and market participants about the current state of these institutions and about how they're going to try to move beyond their current problems.
The market's already fallen almost 50% from its highs, so Christopher Thornburg of Beacon Economics says there's no advantage to Treasury keeping anyone in the dark. As for regular bank customers, they're protected.
We have here in the U.S. deposit insurance, and it's been expanded recently up to $250,000 for most accounts. And no matter how bad off the banks are, people can pretty much rest assured that their particular deposits are okay.
He says if the bailout plan lacks transparency, it's because the administration's still working out what to do. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
We mentioned yesterday the Treasury Department has set up a website to let the public track which banks are getting government money and what they're doing with it. Financialstability.gov is the address. I'm checking right now in the studio. It still says this site coming soon. Commentator Robert Reich says transparency is great in theory. What's not so good is what it might mean in practice.
The Geithner plan for rebooting credit markets requires no new legislation, which is politically smart, because after struggling to pass the $800 billion or so stimulus package, Congress is in no mood to do more, and the public is still furious about the whole idea of bailing out Wall Street. Now, how does Geithner do it? By using the remaining $350 billion Congress has already authorized to bail out the street, the public will have a better idea how this money is used than they had with the first bailout. But for the rest of the $2 trillion or more that the plan will require, Geithner relies on the Federal Reserve's seemingly infinite capacity to backstop almost anyone putting up almost any collateral. The idea is to lure private investors into buying up the bank's toxic assets by having the Fed limit their downside risks. If private investors pay too much, the Fed picks up the tab. This is not a model of transparency. To date, the Fed has already committed some $2.5 trillion to rescuing the financial system, yet no one outside the Fed knows exactly how or where this money went. The Fed is subject to almost no political oversight. Yet if the trillions of dollars the Fed has already committed and the trillions more it's about to commit can't be recouped, the federal debt explodes and you and I and other taxpayers are left holding the bag. In other words, Geithner and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke continued to do pretty much what Hank Paulson and Bernanke did. They hide the true costs and risks to taxpayers of repairing the banking system. Those risks and costs should be put on the people who made risky bets on the banks in the first place, namely bank shareholders and creditors. Shareholders of the most troubled banks should be wiped out entirely. Bank creditors, except depositors, should take major hits. And top executives who were responsible should be canned. But it's politically easier to put the costs and risks on taxpayers, especially in ways they can't see. Geithner's plan is better than the first Wall Street bailout, but it's not transparent. And it's still a bailout.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also an author, most recently, of a book called Super Capitalism. You can write to us. Online is best. Marketplace.org is our website. Click on that link that says contact. Goodness knows you've heard the word a lot on this program. You've probably used it yourself at some point in the past couple of years. Sustainability. Companies have caught on, too. A lot of them have launched what they call sustainability initiatives, doing well by doing good. That usually means cutting energy and water use and waste, too. They've hired sustainability directors, carefully calculated their carbon footprints, and banished styrofoam from the lunchroom. We wondered, though, whether it's still easy to be green in a recession. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
500 well-dressed professionals armed with blackberries and strong coffee pack an auditorium in San Francisco for a conference on green business.
Wow, look at y'all. Either this is a hot topic or there's a whole lot more people without jobs than I thought.
No, these sustainability execs are fully employed, thank you very much, and they want to keep it that way. Maybe that's why they all stress the cost-saving nature of their work.
We are driving upwards of $60 million off the bottom line.
So there is a lot of hidden value in doing the right thing.
So our work is actually becoming more important in the company.
These execs told us their companies had no plans to cut back in-house sustainability programs, whether that means installing more efficient heating systems, conserving water, or using less packaging. Of course, these guys all work for companies still willing to pony up the travel money for green conferences, so you figure their employers are pretty committed to this stuff already. So we tracked down John Davies from the research outfit Green Biz Intelligence. He gave us the bigger picture.
We didn't see a lot of new hiring. We saw a lot of hiring freezes.
Davies spent 2 months surveying over 100 companies, most of them in the Fortune 500. About a quarter of them told Davies they were actually expanding their environmental budgets this year. Another quarter admitted they planned to cut those budgets. And the other half, well, they were simply going to tread water. Conference organizer Joel McCower insisted that marked a notable shift in corporate behavior.
Companies in the past, whenever there's been a downturn, companies have sort of said, okay, let's take a step back. And, oh, by the way, the economy's bad. Let's get rid of their whole environmental department because, you know, no one's suing us today. That's not happening right now.
So corporate green hasn't withered on the vine, but it's not blooming either. That's especially true for companies just starting down a greener path.
We're seeing a great deal of uncertainty.
Gil Friend runs Natural Logic, a firm that advises corporations on greening their operations. Friend says many are delaying decisions on new programs, like a large food company that recently hired him.
They're uncertain where the capital flows are coming from, so they're going a little bit slower.
Companies, Friend says, believe sustainability will save them money in the end, but worry about spending that money right now when the economy and their businesses are so vulnerable. That's why environmentalists are curious to see whether champion cost-cutter Walmart will stick with green as the recession deepens. We tracked down Walmart sustainability director Matt Kissler at the retailer's offices in D.C.
Now is not the time to slow down. Now is the time to actually accelerate, I believe.
Kissler insisted Walmart won't back off its 2005 goals to power its stores by renewable energy, create zero waste, and sell products that help the environment. They're hardly close. But Walmart's gone much further than many environmentalists expected. Kissler told us Walmart has saved well over $100 million with its recycling efforts alone. But he says they've started investing in clean energy, too.
There are many technologies that we're evaluating and some we are testing at this time that are very new and I think, you know, could be the future of what energy looks like for our company.
Advocates at Environmental Defense say that Walmart plans trying out thin-film solar panels on some stores. That cutting-edge technology could make solar electricity much cheaper. But Walmart's bottom line isn't that different from other companies trying to weather the recession. Our CFO, says Kissler, isn't interested in us not making money. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, just trying to get ahead of the rush of Valentine's Day stories out there. It's 3 days away, by the way, for those who've let the calendar get away from them, like I have. Anyway, if you're planning for a last-minute run by the florists to make things right on Saturday, not so fast. News from warmer parts of the world, South America mostly, is that flower exports to the U.S. are down so far this year, and this is usually the flower-buying season. So that's going to mean one of two things: higher prices, since supplies are short, or lower prices, since florists will offer discounts to stimulate demand. Ain't economics great, right? Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow put on 50 points, two-thirds of 1%. The NASDAQ rose 5 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 gained 2 points. That's a third of 1% as well. All of that after the Senate agreed on a stimulus bill. But remember, the House gets a say, too. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gwartz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Aaron Scott engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, finding the perfect match in Vietnam.
These girls don't want to be with poor guys who drink too much, because those kind of men do nothing to help their wives and their children.
It's another installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.